Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Bethany Gilbert, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Thune and Pastor Dusty White of Coram Deo Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. Every Wednesday, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today we're talking about rethinking church and state.
Also known as how the gospel critiques your 12th grade civics class.
Sounds like a really easy topic.
Did you guys take civics in high school?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I went.
Yes.
I had Mr. Lopez, and I just remember he used to try to like get our attention by just telling us lots of crazy stories about like people getting arrested. And just like basically like he would hook you into thinking about civics by telling you some crazy story of someone, you know, getting arrested or breaking the law or whatever. And this is why we have a justice system, and, you know, kind of get you hooked that way. So if you took 12th grade civics or 11th grade civics or civics at any point in your life, you've probably heard of this idea of the separation of church and state, right? This has become a standard trope of American politics. Surprisingly, if you haven't done your homework on this, you should. This statement is not in the Constitution anywhere, nor is it in any of our founding documents. The phrase comes from a letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote where he talked about separation of church and state. So it's a phrase that was in a letter written by one of the founding fathers that has sort of made its way into our national consciousness. And we're used to thinking of these things as things that should be separated, right? Church and state. And at one level, that expresses the idea that's foundational to American democracy, which is that there's no official state religion, right? This is what makes us different from England. And from, you know, in England, there's the Church of England and it's the official state religion. And by the way, what that means, if you didn't know this, is that it is supported by your tax dollars in England. So if you're an English person and you pay into the tax system, part of that goes to the Anglican Church. And so that's how they pay the bills. It's not from tithing. It's from the taxes of the people because this is the national church. Which, by the way, is why it's really hard to be a church planter in the UK, because if you're a church planter, guess who you don't get money from? The government. You got to raise it all yourself. And if you're in a society where people are used to like, why would I tithe, man? That's what I pay taxes for, right? Like, I pay taxes to support the church. Why would I tithe? That's a whole new way of thinking about how challenging it is to raise
even
funds.
Even if you plant an Anglican church?
Well, if you plant an Anglican church, that's okay. A little different. But then you can only do that with the approval of the Anglican hierarchy,
true.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's a little more politics to be done there. There you go. I just gave...
That's like a little mini sermon.
A little
like
mini civics lesson. Yeah. Global
the more
civics
you
right
know.
Yeah, I like that.
So when we said, you know, when the founders founded this country and they said, hey, there shouldn't be an official state religion in America, most of us are thankful for that because it gives us a freedom of practice of religion and it allows the churches in our country, whatever their persuasion, to be funded by the free donations of individuals rather than by tax dollars. And generally, we think that's a good thing. But here's what tends to happen with that. We have been formed by this idea of the separation of church and state. And so we have a tendency to separate issues of church from issues of state. And one of the things Jamie Smith wants to do in his book, Awaiting the King, is to challenge that, to say, have we learned to think in those two categories in ways that are unhelpful? Here's what's interesting to me as a church planter. For years now, I've been telling people at Coram Deo, hey, the reason we named our church Coram Deo is because all of life under the, you know, before the face of God, under God, for the glory of God, there's not sacred and secular spaces in your life. There's not like, you know, church happens on Sunday and the rest of life is divorced from God. Part of the reason that people are so prone to think that way in America is because of the formative effect of thinking about the separation of church and state. And we've just been taught our whole lives to say, hey, church fits in one category, and issues of politics and the public square, and those fit in another category, and those categories don't go together. So Smith says, what this causes us to do is we wear our Christian identity and our political identity separately. Okay, so I'm a Christian, and I'm also, you know, I have certain political persuasions, and I generally hold those things in tension, is sort of how I think how we could think about it. That I generally don't ask, how does my identity as a Christian need to critique, need to challenge, need to inform my political identity and convictions? Now, even though we would say we all do that, we're like, well, of course, if you're a Christian, you should think like I do about politics, right? Like that's how it generally works. It's like, hey, guess what? I have allowed the gospel to inform my politics, and that's why I think the way I do. Why are you such a moron? Because you don't agree with me, right? And so let me frame up the debate that Smith wants to start with us, and then we'll sort of frame it out a little bit or talk about it a little bit. Where I'm going to land is to say, I think Jamie Smith wants to encourage us to think about being the church for the state instead of church and state as separate spheres. Okay. We talked about this a little bit two podcasts ago, but this is a cleaner and clearer way of describing it. So Smith says, we can learn from the example of Abraham Kuyper, who is a Dutch prime minister from right around the year 1900. And he is also the leader of the church in the Netherlands. And he was battling on two fronts. On the one hand, you had the national church. And on the other hand, you had sectarianism. Okay, and the national church folks tended to basically include civil society in the church. So think of this as similar to modern day liberal Christianity, which is like, hey, everybody's good. Everybody's a great person. Everybody cares about having a society that works for us all. And so there's no clear line between the church and the world. And so what we end up with is we just baptize the world into the church, and there's no clear separating, distinguishing features. Sectarianism made the opposite mistake, which was to retreat from the world and therefore sort of abandon responsibility for civil society and say, hey, that's not our problem. You guys figure out the problems of society and who should do what when it comes to, you know, the social problems of the world. We're just going to go over here and, take care of our own. And Kuyper argues against both of those and says that the church and the world, we ought to think of them as two concentric circles. So let me read this quote from Abraham Kuyper. Though the lamp of the Christian religion only burns within that institute's walls, its light shines out through its windows to areas far beyond, illuminating all the sectors and associations that appear across the wide range of human life and activity. And so, end quote there from Kuyper. And so Jamie Smith says we could picture these as concentric circles. That what the church is to do is to nourish a vibrant core of believers who then, as an organism, infiltrate and leaven the society. So it's sort of like, think of it as the church gathered and the church scattered. We gather to nourish a vibrant core of disciples of Jesus who then scatter to sort of have a leavening influence in society. And in this way, we have the right understanding of how our life as the church affects our life in the world. I think that I'm intrigued by that because I think he's just framing out the vision I think we've tried to embrace as churches and as church planters, is to say we want to make disciples who then will live on mission with Jesus in their various spheres of influence and have influence in society, whether that means their neighborhood or whether that means the city council or whether that means working for social justice like we talked about last podcast. That's what we're talking about. And I think Smith is just saying, hey, that's harder to do when people have these clean categories of church and state that are supposed to exist in separate categories. And so part of what has to happen is the gospel has to sort of demolish our categories first so that we rethink that the church exists for the good of the state, that the church exists for the good of the world or for the life of the world. And therefore, to the extent that we are the church and that we faithfully make disciples of Jesus and give ourselves the kind of vision God has for the world, then we're sent out to begin to sort of express that in all kinds of various ways in society. I really resonated with that little thought. And I think it does require us then to rethink as Americans. At least it forced me to rethink. Maybe this podcast is just for me, y'all, and I'm just talking to myself, which... That's actually not unusual. sometimes I need to think out loud.
We're here. Keep going.
But this makes me rethink sort of the way that American civics has taught me to think about the world, which is to say, hey, my church is a sequestered off reality of where I go with Christian friends to do Christian things, and I don't get to bring that into the world over here. This is the state, and the state is secular, and it's a non-sacred space, and don't bring your religion over in here. And this seems to say something, I think, compelling about that, to say, hey, the church is to be the church for the world.
How do you embrace this without devolving into the Christian right?
Well, yeah, you asked that on a recent podcast, I think. Have you gotten any more thoughts in your own head to the answer to that question?
Maybe.
How would you answer your own question?
So, you're going to get Chris working out his own thoughts live. I'm not an external processor, so this might not be clear. Just a caveat.
This has never happened before.
But I wonder, I wonder that phrase, the church for the state, if you sort of tease out the meaning of that, is it different than the state for the church? In the sense that whether you're Christian right or Christian left, which you seem to see this a little bit more with the Christian right, that I'm infiltrating the state for the purpose of laws, power, whatever I need to sort of turn back and establish some sort of control that is my team. It almost seems like this my team kind of sense, or I don't know, there seems to be a tribalism to it that devolves from I'm for the blessing of the world. And it may be what we were talking back last week, where we're saying kind of this gospel third way that's able to critique both sides, where what it seems to be the Christian right is it sort of just devolves into a tribalism where the conservative Christian side wins out. This is what's truth. This is how it's supposed to be. And if you critique it, it's a liberal. So maybe as I'm thinking about this, the one of the things, I'm not saying this is the only thing, but one of the things is an avoidance of a tribalism that creates this space where you no longer critique your team, quote unquote.
Okay, yeah, I was going to ask you, what's the practical outworking of that? And I think you just said it, which is you don't critique your team, you just assume you're right.
Yeah, yeah. And I think also, too, I hear again shades of James Hunter, of that faithful presence that doesn't make power the end game. Like, I have to have control of power. And so if I'm the church for the state, that isn't reduced to I have a position of power.
Yeah, but I think we can over critique there, Chris. I'm with you. I have this flinchiness toward the religious right because that, like, I've seen the deleterious effects of that, right? But there's also this sense in what Smith works out in Awaiting the King is to say, but the Christian vision of flourishing is the best vision of flourishing for humanity. And so at some point, we have to go win the persuasive battle there and say, hey, right, we actually believe this is for the world. Like, this isn't just Christians saying, the policy we think is best, but it's saying, hey, we want to see the flourishing of the common good, and this actually is that. This actually furthers that. And that's going to be a debate and a fight because there are going to be people who say, no, that's not in the common good. That's not in the best interest of the world. That's you know, a particular vision of the flourishing of humanity that I disagree with.
Yeah, yeah, and yeah, so that's a fair critique. That's
so
fair pushback,
I guess what I'm saying is I just don't feel like there ever you can get away from the power dynamics.
Right. No,
now,
that's a good point.
I don't like what the right has done with that, but it just feels to me like, yeah, I don't know that the answer is to sort of shun all of that and say, well,
no, and
let's not ever have a fight with anyone.
I agree, and that's a fair point. And maybe it's how you engage that, because if you look at someone like Ben Sasse versus someone like Ted Cruz, and sorry if there's Ted Cruz fans in our listenership, I'm going to critique your boy. Sorry. But
send your comments to Chris at podcast.
Bring them on. I'm happy. Happy to discuss. But one of the things that I appreciate about Ben Sasse is he has staked out a position. He is within the Republican Party, but he is not afraid to critique his tribe, his side. There seems to be a willingness to push back where things need to be pushed back. And again, I could be wrong. You can prove me wrong about Ted Cruz, but Ted Cruz seems to be a little bit more of this, I am going to throw shots at the other side. Power for me is about power for my tribe or me individually. So there's just a different way of engaging it. So I agree with you, Bob, that you can't avoid the power. You can't avoid that there is good in wanting to establish positions of influence that can help flourishing in society. We shouldn't downplay that. But how you engage that. So maybe again, if
a more provocative way to say what you're saying is to say you can be a good politician and a bad Christian.
Yes. Yes.
And instead we want you to be a good politician and a good Christian.
I want the church for the world, not the church for the Republican Party or the Democrat Party or whatever.
Or the church for the church.
Yeah, there right. You go. There you go.
Because that's where I think if we see, this is where I think it takes a different kind of courage to have the courage to say, because the separation of church and state, here's I think what's driven the religious right is to say, hey, we're not asking for everyone to agree with us. We just want freedom to do our thing where we want to do it with the people we want to do it with. And so just leave us alone and let us do our thing. And our thing includes like lower taxes and flourishing families and family values. And so if you start messing with that stuff, we're going to get pissed, you know? But and there are some people, I think, who see that as for the good of the world. But I think for a lot of people, that can be like for the good of a particular subset of the world. It takes a different kind of courage to say, hey, actually, your vision of life is bad for the flourishing of humanity. And I need to convince you of that. You think this is good for people, but it's actually not good for people. And so let's have a conversation about that. And let me have the conviction that the kingdom of God, God's ways of doing things, the way of life given in the Bible, actually is the best way to live. And so I am unapologetically going to say that's the best way to live. Now, I may or may not be able to legislate that in a democracy, but I with conviction can say I do think that's for the good of the world. I just think that's the kind of, I don't hear a lot of people saying that. I hear a lot of Christians sort of taking a defensive posture that says, whether you think it's good or not, I want my rights.
Yeah.
I have a right to live, you know, I have a right to have these convictions. Instead of saying, what's best for people? What's best for humanity? What's for the flourishing and common good of society? Let's talk about that. Let's have that conversation. And that conversation has become so fraught with anger and conflict and disagreement that maybe it's just a hard conversation to have.
One of the interesting things that I'm thinking about here is in working with police officers is I think the majority of people in law enforcement get into law enforcement because they genuinely want to help people or they want to bring order. Mm-hmm. But then they end up, most of them, I shouldn't say all, most end up jaded, cynical towards people in general and towards law. And I think the same is true about politics to what you're saying. So I don't know how you avoid
that's a good point.
I don't know how you avoid the power dynamic or the this is my team dynamic. But I think that's why guys like Sasse are intriguing, because he's willing to say, I'm going to go to the flourishing of people, and you might label me as a Republican right now. And so you're going to take shots at my team, but I'm going to try to avoid the power play and the need for my power back and just go towards flourishing of people. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's similar to, so when I hear the Kuiper idea, I think, man, that's actually where the blendedness comes in. And sure, you're going to associate me with whoever you want to associate with, but I'm going to die to the fear of man and just go for the flourishing of good.
Yeah. One of the challenges though, Bob, I think in our context is, and I don't say this with any sort of judgment on it, just saying this is just the reality of the fact that culturally speaking, so many different views of human flourishing and different, I mean, we are a multicultural right. Yeah. society in some ways, and those influences have given us a diversity of views of human flourishing that Kuiper never had to face.
Right.
And so that even creates challenges in of itself. And again, you know, the right's view of that is a homogenous society. The left's view is, hey, diversity is our strength, and so let's just keep running with it. Is there a gospel third way even there?
Chris, in light of what you just said, here's what's interesting to me. This idea that the church nourishes a vibrant core of believers who infiltrate and leaven civil society. I wonder if what we might need to embrace here is the church hasn't done its job, and that's why we are where we are. If, because I wrote myself a little parenthetical note about the how. Because here's my, we talked about this a few weeks ago, but the challenge with reading Jamie Smith is he's a philosopher, and so his thinking is very high level. And when you start asking, well, how would that work itself out? You get into, I don't know, you know, there's not a whole lot of clarity there. But I think as we talk about this, the question a concrete-minded listener has is, okay, great, but how does this change what I do or how I live my life? I think I would say this. If the church, broadly speaking, was nourishing a vibrant core of disciples who love the Lord Jesus Christ, who understand his word, who are shaped by the gospel, if that were the norm for the 25 to 30% of American society that identifies as Christian, would that not change how you were able to live this out in your neighborhood, right? So think about if all the people at your workplace or all the people in your neighborhood who were Christians had a vibrant sense of discipleship to Christ. I think it would be actually easier to figure out what does common cause look like. Part of the challenge is there are so many malnourished forms of Christianity, right, that have not robustly made disciples of Jesus. And so the church in society has no consistent witness because it's basically a bunch of little fragmented isolated different kinds of visions of the kingdom of God. And so I wonder if like the renewal of the church is for the life of the world. Like the thing, why do we care about in our mission statement at Coram Deo, cultivating spiritual renewal? Because actually that's for the good of the city. Like if the churches are more renewed and develop more vibrant disciples of Christ, that has an effect on what it means to work at Union Pacific and have dozens of Christians in your department, right? Well, what it would mean is if you had dozens of Christians that were really robustly disciples of Jesus, that's different than dozens of people who go to church somewhere once a month, right? Or who attend a Bible study. Not that those things are bad, and I'm not trying to, you know, rag on those things, but just to say that's the renewal of the church. This puts the focus squarely on the renewal of the church as part of our calling in the world, instead of just, all right, let me go to church and do my thing over there so that I can go be politically active over here.
Yeah,
which makes a lot of sense. And that's why I've had the Faith and Work podcast echoing around in my chambers the whole time we've been talking about this, because it's a similar thing. My Christianity is going to inform and infiltrate everything else that we're involved in, not separate it.
And here's an interesting wrinkle on this, is sort of like bringing in another thread from Smith's book. He has a whole little aside where he talks about the importance of the little platoon, what he calls the little platoon, families, local churches, parishes, you know, little communities of people. And he says this has always been core to Christian social thought. This is true in both the Catholic and Protestant tradition. It's not true in modern progressivism. Modern progressivism, the lever progressives pull is the lever of the state. So it's like the government needs to solve the problems of society. And for that reason, Smith argues, hey, a lot of people hear good Christian proposals for change as automatically conservative because they don't immediately reach for the lever of government. And they say, oh, you think the family is important in that. Well, what about people who don't have a family? What about broken families? What about kids in a single parent household? You know, like it immediately goes to all the the places where that is malformed. But Smith says, hey, part of what Christians ought to be fighting for in the world is the importance of the little platoon, the importance of the family and the local church, not as the only means, but as more effective, localized means of shaping people for the common good. And so, and I remembered as I was reading that part, I wrote this blog post maybe a year ago now, called Why Christians Should Be the Right Kind of Conservatives. I had the right kind of in parentheses. Like, because I want to say why Christians should be conservatives, because the word conservative means we're trying to conserve something, right? So I wasn't trying to start a political argument. I was trying to say, if you don't think it's important to conserve something, then you're probably not a Christian, because Christians are conserving 2,000 years of church history and of a tradition that's been passed on to us. And so we have to care about conserving that. Wherever we think we should go from here, we can't be only thinking about the future. We have to be conserving what's been given to us. And I got a bunch of flack and a bunch of, you know, crazy angry comments on that post, because people are like, well, see, you just think Christians need to be conservatives. And I'm saying, no, what does the word mean? The word means we're trying to conserve and preserve the centrality of the family, the school, the local church, the synagogue, the social club, the bowling alley, like the little platoons of small communities that have always been core to deep social formation in America. And the more we lose those small societies, the more government is the only lever we have left to pull. And that puts us in really dangerous places, because now no one thinks that government is the most effective and efficient means of solving a problem. It's just the most, it's just the strongest, right? It's the one that has the most, I don't want to say power, but the longest tentacles into our lives and can actually, you know, demand our allegiance because we pay taxes and because we are citizens and because we are a part of these, you know, institutions of society. But we have to understand the common good as involving something more than just the lever of government, but all these smaller little platoons. And so that, again, if all we hear is separation of church and state, we tend to put the change in either the category of church or state. right? Oh, well, this is a problem. Should this problem be solved by the church or by the state? But there's actually all these little gradations in between of like, well, what about what? Where do families fall, and where do schools fall, and where do neighborhood associations fall, and where do all these little sort of civic institutions fall in that spectrum? Well, they're kind of in between those two, and there are ways in which, as Christians scatter out into the world, we can actually have meaningful involvement for the public good in all these little sort of varied ways and nuanced ways and small local ways.
And I think that gets at another one of my issues of the jumping immediately from the church to the state, like the powers and the levers of government, and sort of skipping over or jumping to those in order to get at these other things. And that just seems to me reductionistic and too maybe too heavy-handed. Or maybe the problem is if we don't consider all those kind of civic smaller spaces, that's when we devolve into tribalism, because to exist in those things, you have to love your neighbor. You have to be engaged locally. So,
because your neighbor probably isn't the same political party
exactly,
as you.
Exactly. So to be for the state, let's think of it in the society in all its nuances and variables, that begins to address, I think, and get at, okay, that I get behind, that I see, that I can see not devolving into the tribalism.
Yeah. So to put a sort of a big bow on the sort of theme, the gospel needs to deconstruct the way we've been taught to separate church and state and put those in separate categories. And it needs to start bringing those together to where we see our involvement in the church and the flourishing of the church as good for the state and as a means of shaping and influencing for the good society. And so for those of us who are have a hard time bringing those two worlds together, because the church exists in one on one side of the spectrum and sort of like the state and politics exists on another side of the spectrum, we need to allow the gospel to integrate those so that we understand our core calling as disciples of Jesus, and then that filtering out into the various ways that we involve ourselves for the common good in society. I'll share something that Jamie said that was really provocative to me personally, because it concerns a critique I've often received in the last 3 years. And it was really helpful for him to frame this up, because I was like, yes, that puts words on something I've been feeling, but I haven't been able to say it or haven't known how to say it. You guys know, 3 years ago now, I helped to start a private Christian school because I care about education. And one of the knocks on that is, oh, well, that school costs money. It's private. Therefore, it's only for kids who can afford it. Therefore, you're leaving out all the kids in our city who can't afford that kind of education. Therefore, you're actually a bad person who's just favoring the privileged few who can afford a private education. One, that just rankles me, because I'm like, well, thanks. I appreciate your affirmation. But two, it's one of those, like, I get the objection, and it's a fair objection. Like, there's a sense in which, yes, the particular kind of education we're providing, because it's a private school, there are certain people who don't have access to that. And I get that critique, and that critique bothers me, because I'm like, I there's something about this, though, that feels to me like I did not start this school so that I could, so that I could favor a select few. I started it because I care about a certain vision of education. Jamie, when he was in Omaha, spoke at our school. And one of the things he said, he went on this little 5-minute sidebar that was just brilliant to me. And he said, hey, can I just encourage you not to let people talk about this as a private school? He said, this is the most public kind of school there is. Here's what I mean. The kind of people that you're shaping at this school, the kind of character that you're imparting in this school, the kind of care for the good of the world that you're giving here, the kids who grew up and graduate from the school will be great to have as neighbors. They'll be great to have as employees. They'll be the kind of people you're glad are in the world. For that reason, this is for the good of society. It might feel like it's only accessible to a certain few, but I want to help you see the bigger vision, that what you're actually doing is you're producing public citizens that are really going to be a blessing to the world. And when he said that, I was like, yes, that's the vision that drives me, is not, gosh, let me just provide an education for those who can afford it. But I actually think education is about forming people in a certain kind of way. All education forms us. How do we want to form people? What does it mean to form people with a Christian vision of what is good and virtuous and true and beautiful? And if we do that well, I do think those people are a blessing to society. Those people help the flourishing of the whole. and it just he basically just tweaked the thinking about public and private and said, hey, the way we use those words in education isn't helpful because it's not actually a true expression of the words. This education is not merely for a few. This education is for the public good, in the way it thinks about the forming of people. And so that gets at a little bit of what he's trying to say here, is to break down these dichotomies that we have and to say, what does it mean for us to be a people who are for the good of the world? And for the good of the world in the broadest mm-hmm. sense, where we're trying to just help further human flourishing by raising people, training people, discipling and developing people to be great citizens in the world who live for the glory of God, but also for the good of their neighbor.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own church for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, we thank you for listening in and we pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. We always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send us an email, podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next Wednesday for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.